I just want to thank you again for that wonderful opportunity. That was really a pleasure. Today we're going to talk about the characteristics of available IV iron products. And when I mean characteristics, I mean the structure and chemistry and their implications for both safety and bioactivity. If we've been using IV iron products since 1950 or so. That's when iron dextran came out, iron sucrose is shortly thereafter, ferric gluconate in the 1960s. And it was sometimes later that they were then used for IV use, but later means 1960s and 1970s. We did all of that, we've done this 50-some years of administration of IV iron, without really knowing what they are and how they work. It's as if we had used calcium channel blockers and we didn't know that they block calcium channels. This has been a problem for us because now that we have several available IV iron products to use, and we talk about safety on the one hand with increasing information about safety and bioactivity on the other hand, which is about efficacy, then we need some way of sorting this in our heads about how it happens, why it happens, and in what order it happens. And that will only be more important in the future as new IV iron products are introduced. So today we're going to talk about chemistry and structure of IV iron, and the really big new stuff is stuff that came from Dina Kudasheva and Mary Kalman, who are chemists, colloid chemists in New York, and just done some really wonderful breakthrough work. A little bit about pharmacokinetics, and I'll tell you now and I'll tell you then that pharmacokinetics has very little to do with IV iron, except perhaps for how often you give a dose. And then we'll talk about the understanding of safety and bioactivity when we talk about labile iron or the so-called free iron business. Well, IV iron agents are all spheroidal particles with an iron core and a carbohydrate shell. The core is most of it, and the shell is just a thin shell around it. The core is all iron oxyhydroxide. The core of each agent is the same from one to the other. It's the carbohydrate that's different between them, and it's the size of the core that's different between them. So for iron sucrose, it's bound sucrose around an oxyhydroxide core, and for ferric gluconate, it's bound gluconate around a weakly associated sucrose around a somewhat smaller oxyhydroxide core. There's differences between ferric gluconate and iron sucrose. Those differences are minor compared to the size differences between those two and iron dextran. Iron dextran is a huge molecule with a huge core. As iron oxyhydroxide crystallizes, it becomes ellipsoidal, sort of like a football, or actually more like a rugby ball. The dextran then sizes up around it and makes the whole unit into a spheroid. When I think about the molecular weight, the whole molecular weight of the agent, I think that's probably the primary determinant of the pharmacokinetics, of how quickly it's cleared from the bloodstream. It may be something related to how many carbohydrates are on the molecule, so that like the difference between EPID and alpha and darbepoetin, the carbohydrates more on darbepoetin, slows the clearance of these things down. But the primary determinants of iron bioactivity are not the total molecular weight, but the size of the core, the actual core size to surface area to volume ratio. Pharmacokinetics are reviewed in this slide. The disappearance of IV iron after you inject it into the venous system, it's very slow for the iron dextran products, and it's slowest for the largest molecular weight product, which is dexferum, a little bit less slow for iron dextran infed, which is close to Inferon. How many in the room remember Inferon? Okay, now I know how old you are. At the other end of the spectrum is free iron, absolutely free iron, so ferric ammonium citrate, for example. That iron is totally 100% bioavailable immediately, and it just exits the plasma space and just binds onto something else, and it's gone immediately. So in between those extremes are iron sucrose with a half-life of about 7 hours, 6 or 7 hours, and ferric gluconate, which has a half-life of about an hour. So there seems to be a sort of a direct link between plasma half-life and molecular weight. And having said that, the significance of all of pharmacokinetics is probably that the larger the agent you have, like an iron dextran, the more it makes sense to give that once a week. And the smaller the molecular weight agent, like ferric gluconate or iron sucrose, the more it makes sense to give that one as often as once a day, or certainly three times a week on dialysis would be your maximum frequency for administering that drug. And that has to do with circulating agent that can interfere with iron tests. So where does it go after you give it? Well, it goes into the reticular endothelial system. And we knew that about iron dextran. And the same is true about the other iron agents. This is a more recent study with labeled iron 59 iron sucrose. And you can see that the uptake is into the liver and spleen. Liver is the high blood flow organ, so more goes into the liver than in the spleen, but quantitatively that's the difference. Qualitatively, it's the same rate for both of them. And then it's transferred slowly into the marrow by that intermediate step of binding to transferrin, and then the transferrin delivers the iron to the marrow. So look at the time course here. This is in minutes. The uptake of iron sucrose into the liver and the spleen is nearly complete within an hour to 2 hours, and then the transfer to the marrow is taking place. So ultimately, change the time period here to days rather than hours. What happens is that the iron that went into the marrow then transfers into new blood cells and becomes part of the circulating red cell mass, so that in a patient who's very iron avid, the patient with rapid erythropoiesis and hungry for iron, that patient will transfer all the injected dose into the circulating red cell mass within 10 to 20 days. And when I say all, I mean 90 to 100%, something along that line. This is not to suggest that you would get the same sort of curve with a patient with very slow erythropoiesis who, for example, had cancer. No erythropoietin treatment and cancer. It was a very slow rate of erythropoiesis, and that's why the anemia happens. That patient, the iron would be left in the RES and would not be transferred into new red blood cells. And so the curve would be relatively flat. It's very interesting how that happens. It's totally not understood what regulates that, if it's regulated or not. I think I'm getting some music. Should I dance? Are they telling me to stop? So in conclusion, on the first part, as we talk about chemistry and structure, all IV iron agents are colloidal particles. They differ by core size and by shell carbohydrate type and by the strength of that bond. The pharmacokinetics are, they follow core size and total molecular weight. All iron agents have a principal movement of iron from the plasma into RES, from the RES onto transferrin, from transferrin into the marrow, and from marrow into red blood cells. About 5% or less of iron will short circuit the cells in the RES and go directly onto transferrin, and we'll talk about how that works. So pharmacokinetics, somebody's talking to you about pharmacokinetics, you know, I suggest that your eyes glaze over and you walk away. Because really the only important thing I think about pharmacokinetics is that it determines how often you give the dose. And if you're giving doses in the range that we give, which is 100 milligrams to 200 milligrams, iron dextran is no more often than once a week, and iron sucrose and iron ferric gluconate are probably as frequently as once a day, or whatever fits logically with your patient group. So that brings us to labile iron effects. This is bioactive iron. Bioactive iron is how the iron gets from the compound to do its work. This is both an issue of efficacy, because it can't be effective unless iron gets off of that core to where it's going to go ultimately to the marrow. But however effective it is, it must also have some safety issues, because bioactive iron is also the core of the safety issue. So we'll examine those things together. We have known for a long time about the manifestations of labile iron, and the evidence is accumulating in the literature rather quickly. We know that it falsely elevates serum transferrin level. If you gave iron dextran tomorrow to a patient on a Monday, Wednesday, Friday schedule, and you did a TSAT on Friday, your TSAT would be high because there'd be circulating iron dextran in the plasma of that patient. We know that, in addition, there's direct transfer of iron onto transferrin, and that happens very quickly. And it goes right from the agent onto transferrin without having to go through the cells, and it happens with all of these agents. We know that it provokes oxidative stress. No surprise, it's bioactive iron. It will have an oxidative manifestation. It impairs neutrophil functions, and it can stimulate bacterial growth, because iron is needed for replication of bacteria. Well, we knew that there was some relationship between molecular weight and the degradation rate of agents. And Peter Geiser had shown this in 1992, just in vitro, and he had shown that and with all the available iron products that he could get his hands on, there was this relationship between molecular weight and degradation kinetics. But that doesn't explain the whole thing. The evidence that iron agents donate iron directly to transferrin is old, and it's recently been confirmed, and we have some sense of the sequence in which that happens. So old is iron dextran from the 1960s. About the time that IV iron dextran was first used intravenously. Esposito showed that ferric gluconate donated more than iron sucrose, donated more than iron polymaltose in a test system that he reported on in 2002, but there was no quantitative difference. And then polymaltose, by the way, is a slightly larger molecular weight than iron sucrose, and is used in some countries around the world. Ferric gluconate greater than iron sucrose, greater than iron dextran, was something that I demonstrated earlier this year, and Rajiv Agarwal demonstrated in June, and I'll show you that data. When we mixed agents in serum, and we looked at, and then we took the agent out of the serum through a column, we looked at transferrin saturation before and transferrin saturation after the column, after adding the agent. And what we found was that indeed there was some donation. It wasn't very much, it was only on the order of 4 to 6% maximum. But that sequence, ferric gluconate greater than iron sucrose, greater than iron dextran, and among the iron dextrans, in-fed greater than dextferrin, that was the sequence that worked. And so that sort of made sense. It was the first quantitative study, in vitro study. Rajiv Agarwal just published in June in KI this interesting study in which he did the same sort of thing. He incubated iron, and then he looked at evidence for transferrin saturation. And first, he fixed the incubation time at 60 minutes, that's your first frame, and varied the drug concentration. And he found that there was a concentration-related increase in transferrin saturation if the incubation time was 60 minutes. 60 minutes is a long time to be incubating because these agents are cleared from the plasma fairly quickly. So on the other hand, then he fixed the concentration at 100 micrograms per deciliter, and he varied the incubation time. And what he showed was that there was some donation that occurs right away, but as incubation time progresses, there's more donation over time. And that in general, the sequence was of effect was ferric gluconate greater than iron, sucrose greater than iron dextran, as everybody else had demonstrated. Well, how do you explain this? I think it's just simple math, that for equal amounts of iron, the smaller the core, the greater the surface area available for iron release. The surface area to volume ratio is not linear. Just remember, volume is radius cubed, and it's something like that. So it's not linear. Iron dextran is way out to the edge because it's a really big effective radius, and although there are small differences between iron sucrose and ferric gluconate in radius, because they're on the steep part of the curve as small molecules, there are measurable differences in surface area to volume ratio. And that's shown in this cartoon. We have sort of grapes. The volume, the red part here of the core, is the same on both sides. You have small molecules with small cores, large molecules with large cores. The volume is the same. The surface area to volume ratio is obviously much greater among the small molecular weight agents, and I believe that iron bioactivity comes from that. That's just simple. If you think about redox active iron, oxidative stress is probably on the unsafe side. That's the safety issue rather than the effectiveness issue of these agents. You would expect to see the same sequence of oxidative stress results. And ferric gluconate greater than iron sucrose greater than iron polymaltose was shown by Esposito. Ferric gluconate greater than iron sucrose greater than iron dextran, also shown by others. And in some, things get reversed, or it's close, or there's no differences. I think the whole oxidative stress story is not very important at doses and infusion doses and cumulative doses that we give in standard practice in our dialysis patients. So redox active iron, for example, in Esposito was in this sequence. That having been said, I don't think that oxidative stress that the contribution of iron to oxidative stress is very significant unless you get into very high doses, single doses, or very high cumulative doses of iron with very high ferritins. So if you're thinking about free iron reactions, I just want to remind you about the article in 1932, which you probably have, from famous, now not living, hematologists, who were experimenting in the days before the IRB, and we know that we can give free iron at about 4 milligrams. That is, if you took ferrous sulfate and you dissolved the tablet completely and you gave an injection of that, you could safely give only about 4 milligrams because that's your iron binding capacity that hasn't been bound already. So the only safe way for iron to exist in your plasma is to be bound to transferrin. And that's about 4 milligrams worth. It's not very much. So they increased the dose to 8, and then 16, and then 32, and then 48, and so on, up to 80 milligrams. And they noticed how much more serious the reactions got as they got, and it's sort of interesting, isn't it, huh? So that by the time they got to 48 and 80 milligrams in two patients, there were much more severe reactions. 5 minutes after the injection, there was a flushing of the face, engorgement of the neck veins, and an appearance of intense anxiety. Vomiting occurred, much as it does, after the administration of morphine, and the pulse was rapid and full. The heart sounds loud, and there was moderate hyperpnea. You know, they're really describing cardiovascular collapse without taking the blood pressure. So that's a free iron reaction. That doesn't happen. We don't have free iron in any of these IV iron compounds, and we don't have free iron. You can't dialyze iron off of these compounds, either in vitro or in vivo, and it's been done. We've got that evidence. It's pretty significant. I think probably the only significance is that the reaction rate, the labile iron reaction rate, simulates some of the more minor reactions that were happening as they were dose escalating in that study. So that as you give iron dextran, you can give a lot of iron dextran intravenously quickly. We just tend not to give really large doses of iron dextran because if the patient has anaphylaxis and a large dose, they tend to have long anaphylaxis. So we keep that to about 100 milligrams. Iron sucrose, 200 milligrams over 5 minutes, is now well described, and ferric gluconate, 125 over 10 minutes for an IV push dose, and similarly for IV infusion. So the different rates break down by iron dextran. You could give theoretically faster than iron sucrose, you can give theoretically faster than ferric gluconate, and that's it. I think that just explains the behavior of these agents. And theoretically, if you have a larger molecular weight than iron dextran, you ought to be able to give it even faster. If you had a smaller molecular weight than ferric gluconate, you'd have to give it even slower than ferric gluconate. That, I think, is how we make sense out of the current literature and how we can make sense out of the future literature as well. So if I leave you, it is with the understanding that bioactive iron is common to all agents, that the core radius dictates the effect, and it has to do with the surface area, the volume ratio. The clinical significance of this is really quite limited and probably has to do only with how much you can give and how fast you can give it.